this evening's talk is advertised as a journey into Hasidic thought. So we're going to discuss some ideas, general ideas about Hasidut. Those are the guys who walk around with a long... So it's not going to be an opportunity, but it's not the history. We can touch a little bit on it now, maybe. But we're going to choose a particular era which is central to Jewish philosophy, but specifically in Hasidic literature and Hasidic thought, from which interests myself and I'd like to share. It's such an interesting idea. I'd like to share it with everybody else. So I've been doing a bit of research recently, and we'll share it together. So first of all, just an idea, as a way of introduction, is there are many streams in Judaism. Judaism is not limited. There isn't one way clear as an answer. Judaism is open-minded, and we always know that already from the time of the Torah, there's already 12 tribes in Israel. And all the tribes, the reason why there's 12 tribes is because every tribe represented a different strand, a different approach. Just like everybody in this room has two eyes. You all got two eyes? Thank God. Two ears, two noses. I was just checking that. Jewish one. Okay. Two nostrils. We have the same. We have the same features. We have the same build up, the same structure. But if you look at each other, we all look different. Isn't that amazing? Everyone's have the same things, and we all look different. Isn't that amazing? So said our sages tell us, just like everybody's face is different. We all have the same makeup, but we all look different. So similarly, our thoughts are different. Similarly, our approach, and similarly, our opinions are different. And therefore, it will be incorrect, it will be wrong to say there's one way and everybody must do the same thing. There has to be a variety to keep things fresh, and each person to bring out their own personal strengths in everything that they do. Judaism recognizes God, who created mankind, realizes personal strength, and therefore gives those opportunities. So when the Jewish people crossed the Red Sea, there were 12 tribes who crossed the sea, but it says, you read the Chumash, it doesn't say it's in the Chumash. If you read the Chumash, it said that the sea split, and the Jews went in. In the Midrash, it says that the tribes split into 12 separate channels. So before the channel tunnel, there was already channels before. There was already each tribe crossed over, and they went through the Red Sea, and they went through each tribe. But what's interesting, it says that each tribe, when they went through their own tunnel, it was clear, the walls were clear, they were transparent. Each tribe could see each other. So as you're going through each one, you could see each one as you were going around. So we know they didn't cross the Red Sea, they went around in the semicircle and came back further down on the same side of the river, of the sea. So the question is, why is it? Why did God make this miracle? Okay, they need to go through the Red Sea. Okay, let them all go together. Okay, they need to go separate. Why is it after you transfer? Why did they have to see each other? So one of my teachers once told me, she had an idea. This is the idea he's trying to teach us. That there are 12 tribes in Israel, and there are different approaches. There is a structure, and there's guidelines. We can't just make up our own Judaism and create our own channel. There are 12 channels. There are different channels within the context and the framework of the Torah, which you go through these channels. And each person has their journey, their travel. Each person, sometimes it's from our families, from our homes, sometimes from different backgrounds, from different countries, different customs. We all have a different approach. But it doesn't mean we have to only hear and look narrow-minded and not learn and be inspired from other people. And the answer, and that's why it's transparent. These columns, these channels that we're going through, they're transparent. And the idea is that we should look. Even though we have our own approach, we should look and share from other people. Look, see how these people serve God. How these people, everyone has a different approach and a different stress and how they serve God. How many mitzvahs are there in the Torah? 613. Is it possible to be an expert in all 613 categories? Although there's not 613, there's 613 categories. Right? Which means each mitzvah is a tree. It's got branches and branches. So there's thousands and thousands of mitzvahs. Okay? There are 613 categories of mitzvahs. Is it possible to fulfill all of them to absolute perfection? Yes, sir. Sure? Even rabbis? Everybody. None of us. It's impossible. It's impossible to be an expert in every single one. Almost impossible. It's not possible. And therefore, what over history, what Jews have done, the different movements over different times, they've put a stress on different areas, on different mitzvahs, which they felt was the core mitzvah. In the Talmud, there's a big debate. How many core mitzvahs are there? How many principles? Is it based on 13 principles? Is it based on 10 principles? Is there one principle? And there's a big discussion in the Talmud between the rabbis. Is there one main thing? Because the answer is, what happens is you try and stress on one particular thing, and hopefully that will have a knock-on effect and affect everything else we're doing. Different times in history calls for different focus. In the time of the Hasidic movement, when the Hasidic movement started, there was a time there was a need for inspiration amongst the Jewish people. There was a lot of challenges at the time from a movement called the Maskilim, the Reform movement. And in the Orthodox world, there was different responses on how to keep Jews, religious Jews, on their journey and focus. Hasidism was one approach in how to do this. Well, they did. They tried to stress on certain things. In the time, it was very difficult life for a Jew. Life is difficult. And therefore, the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Yisrael, the Baal Shem Tov, he wanted, one of his goals was Simcha, that you should be a Jew and you should serve God through Simcha. And he felt that if you serve God through Simcha, then that has an effect on everything you do when it comes to study of Torah, when it comes to prayer, when it comes to every single command, every mitzvah that we do, whether it's giving charity, whatever mitzvah we do. If you do it with Simcha, you're happy, you want to be part of this. Maybe it's, oh, I'm a Jew, and there's another pogrom, and there's another concentration camp, then who wants to be part of it? So there were different ways to include people. Simcha was one of the things which the Baal Shem Tov started. However, it actually, there are lots of things over here which the Hasidim movement tried to do. Also, the Hasid, at that time, traditional Judaism actually came quite polarized. If you were a great scholar, because due to the poverty at the time, in the 1700s, if you were, either you were a big Talmudic sage, you were a very great Chacham, Talmud Chacham, or you were wealthy, you were okay. So you had money or knowledge, you were fine. In fact, in many synagogues in Europe, there was two sides to the synagogue. On one side of the synagogue, all the clever people, the rabbis and the wealthy people, that's on one side. On the other side of the synagogue, we won't walk over to this side because here's one side, there was the paupers and the people who, they were poor, they had no opportunity, they were illiterate, they didn't get the chance. So people were not involved in the community. The people, they were on the other side, they were maybe even ostracized, they never got involved in the community. They went to the synagogue, to the shul, they couldn't get called to the Torah, etc. The Baal Shem Tov wanted to include everybody, and therefore the Hasidic movement actually tried to include, did include, say, wealthy people, poor people, illiterate people, chachomim, wise people, everybody. That was another goal of the Hasidic movement. But basically, there's a lot more depth to it, and that's one of the things I want to talk about. There's a big debate about God and the existence of God and the presence of God, the awareness of God. And this is really, there was a big debate between the Baal Shem Tov and at that time the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu of Vilna, who was the traditional Kabbalistic approach to Judaism, and he had the Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. And there was a big debate, and it all goes back to a concept which many of you may have heard this concept for, a Kabbalistic concept called the Tzimtzum. And the reason I bring this now, we're just great, nothing to do with Bart. Anybody heard of Bart? Do you know Bart? Okay, it's nothing to do with him. Okay, Tzimtzum, right, is a Kabbalistic concept which will just scrape the surface, a very deep concept, and for people like me who are ignorant in these matters, we should really be delved into these things, so we'll just try and get a general idea of what it is. But what it will do is help us understand Hasidus and the Hasidic movement and how it influenced practically and how it can influence us as well. How can we share some ideas? So first of all, there's a concept. I'll ask you a question, my friends. Where is God? A Jew, what is belief? Where is God? You may say, I don't know, he's nowhere, I don't believe in God. But where is God? If you believe in a God, where is God? Any suggestions? Buckingham Palace? Sure. There's a little children's book, probably in the children's book, called the little book, which they written about where is God, where this little child is trying to find where is Hashem, where is God, he's looking everywhere. Maybe he's in school, maybe he's in the synagogue, and he goes in, then the ark is opened, and he keeps trying to find everywhere. He's trying to find him everywhere he goes, he can't find him. Eventually, he goes to his father and says, where's God? And he says, well, I can't tell you yet because we still have to discuss the philosophy. So where is God? Imagine your child, you didn't have children yet, close your eyes, imagine you're married and you've got a child, and your child's girlfriend says, Daddy, Mummy, where's God? So what would you say? In the office?
In the mitzvah.
Sorry?
For example.
Where would you say? You'd say in the mitzvah. Okay, so you'd say in halacha, so you'd say. So what's that mean? So if you're so in Shabbat, you're making kiddush. So where is God?
He's
in the wine? He's in the candles? He's in the challah. I'm out here, what does it mean?
He's everywhere.
You say he's everywhere. Does everyone agree? Hashem is everywhere. There's even a song, you know the song? Hashem is here, Hashem, you know that one? Hashem is truly everywhere. Now, I just want to shock you, but that is a song written by Chabad. It's a Chabad song, and Chabad is one of the movements of the Hasidic movement, and therefore that is Hasidic philosophy. That is not according to the traditional understanding of God. I'm going to shock you here. Today, where we are, it's been accepted in Jewish tradition and belief that actually the Hasidim view this as a victory. Because today, if you stop any Jew on the street and you say, "Where is God?" everyone will probably even sing you the song, "He's everywhere!" But before the Baal Shem Tov, if you'd go to a Jew and say, "Where is God?" he'd say, "God's in heaven. God's in heaven." Sounds very Christian, but God is in heaven. And the whole concept is as follows. Let me explain a little bit to you. It's a concept called symptom. Symptom means contraction. Point is as follows. Before God created the world, God was everywhere. There was only God. So everywhere there's God. So now you're going to create a world. So if you're going to create a world, you need to make a place for the Lord. God, there's only God. And of course is the concept. There's only God. If you want to create a world, what do you have to do? You have to make a place for it. So in Kabbalah, you use a concept. It says God, there's something called Tzimtzum. God contracted. And basically he withdrew himself from here. There's now a vacuum. In that vacuum, in that hole, he creates the world. So where is God now? God is external to that world. God is outside. That doesn't mean God's not involved in the world. Doesn't mean he went off to Honolulu and God's sitting on a crater of the world and went on sitting under a palm tree drinking pineapple juice. Doesn't mean that. It means God still runs the world, but he's controlling it from the outside. He's watching, he's guarding, it's called Hashgacha. He's watching the world. Soiviv kol almen, that's called. He surrounds the world. He's looking at the world from the outside. That doesn't mean that God's not involved in the world. There's still a concept called Shekhinah. There's some sort of presence on some level in the world. But basically, the concept was, Tzimtzum is God contracted. It was taken literally. God contracted his presence. He removed that, created a vacuum, boom, here goes the world. God is Soiviv Kamal. Along come the Baal Shem Tov and the Hasidic movement, and what he brought along, and you can imagine this brought war into the Jewish world at the time. He said, God is not, you can't take that concept literally. When the Kabbalah says God was something, he contracted, it doesn't, you can't say it means that. It looks like he did it. It looks like he contracted himself and removed himself. But read, God is, just like he's soiviv, come on, he's in the outside, he's also memalik al, maybe he also fills the world. Nothing can exist without God. Look under a microscope, everything is made of billions and billions of molecules and atoms. What holds it all together? God. God is in everything. God is just like he's on the outside, he's on the inside, just like he's on the higher spiritual world, he's also down in the physical world. God fills the world, he's outside of the world. God is everywhere. He is everywhere. That was the whole concept. Tzimtzum, therefore the whole concept. Tzimtzum, you can't take it literal. God did not contract himself. It looks like, because for our physical world, if you live in this physical world, can you see God, anybody? You can't see him. So it looks like, where is God? It looks like God contracted and removed himself. He did not actually do it. He's called Hester, but he hid his face. You can't say, but he is here, just like he is in the spiritual realms and spiritual world. Okay? So you can imagine, along comes, there's a famous story. There was a chassid who was, you know, doing his gardening, you know, cutting the grass, and the misnugged was come and say, "Hey, you say God's everywhere. How you're cutting the grass? You're cutting God down. How can you do that? You're walking on the stones." So before, and today, if you ask anybody on the street, everybody, any Jew will say God is everywhere. But that is a philosophy of Hasidic philosophy, and that actually influences many concepts in Hasidic literature and Hasidic thought. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about awareness of God. That means really God, it looks like God withdrew his presence. Really hasn't. He's in this world as much as he is in the spiritual world. My question is, how can we see God? How can we be aware of God? How can we connect with God himself? And that's the question. In Hasidic literature, listen to this, my friends. In Hasidic literature, it says as follows, that the goal is, of Judaism and Hasidic thought, is that just that we should be, our soul and neshama, which we'll talk in a minute, should have so much awareness of God that our spiritual awareness is stronger than our physical senses. So although your eyes tell you there's no God in here, and you can't smell God, you can't hear God, you can't touch God, but your soul, which is kasneh, is struck and overcome and be struck, override all your physical senses and grasp and connect with God. And that's what we're going to discuss this evening, about awareness, the concept of awareness. Just want to share, just as a way of introduction, share another idea with you. They say in the yeshiva world, what's called the Litvish from Lithuanian approach, they say if you want to connect with God, Judaism is about connecting with God. So how do you connect with God? See, in the yeshiva world, the Litvish world, they would say you study God's Torah, like your Rebbe said, Dala Damasar Halacha, his Litvak. Yeah. So it says, if you want to connect with God, because it says in the Kabbalah, in the Zohar, Kutshu Barikha Varaisa Chad, it says the Torah and God are one. If you want to connect with God, study Torah. When we pray, that's how we talk to God. But how does God talk to us? Torah. When we study the Torah, that's when God is actually communicating to us. So if you want to connect with God, you study His Torah. That was one approach. There's another approach which you're going to find very attractive, and that is the Musa approach from the School of Ethics. It says in the Torah that when God made the image of man and woman, He made us in the image of, remember? Himself. Image of? Sorry?
Himself.
So we're made in the Estelim Elokim. Good. Made in the image of God. So if you want to understand God, what's the best thing to do? Understand yourself. So the school of thought called the Muslim movement, who goes into self-analysis of the human being, the human mind, the human character traits, what qualities does it, what strengths do we have, what weaknesses do we have, arrogance, jealousy, the desire and the drive for immorality, for wealth, for honour, all these things, and on the what's the positive drive, how do we redirect these drives into a positive way, understand the human mind. These all things. If you understand the human being, then you know God. You want to know God? Know yourself. Know yourself. You're creating an image of God. That's the Muslim movement. And they say, the Hasidim say, if you want to know God, go straight. Go straight to God. You're a Jew. As it says in the Kabbalah, that every Jew is, we have a soul. A soul is a chelek alakam imal. A soul is a part of God Himself. So we are part of us, part of God. So just go straight there. Just connect with God Himself. So how do we do that? So these are great lofty ideas. Sounds really exciting. Yeah, we connect with God. Our soul can overcome our spiritual, our physical senses, and be aware of God. These are very deep concepts and actually a lifetime's work. So in case you think I'm making this up, I just want to share with you another idea here. There's this quote. It says when we get upstairs, at 120, it says we'll be judged. Anyone know what questions will be asked when we get upstairs from 120? Any idea? 120, we'll leave this world and we'll be judged. A few questions we'll get asked then. Anyone know what the questions are?
Have you enough Torah?
Okay, you say that, okay. I'm not saying you're right, it's one suggestion. Did you study enough Torah or anything else? If you were God, what question would you ask your creatures when they came up the end of their life? Come on.
Charity, yoga. Prayer.
Did you pray? Did you charity? Okay. Anything else?
Were you a good person?
Were you a good person? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good questions. What's the definition of a good person? Okay. So the first question, you're very close actually, sorry?
Maybe if you like your life.
Can't hear you speak again.
If you were like happy with your life.
If you were happy, okay. Good questions. By the way, all these questions you should be thinking of, gentlemen. Because these questions we should be asking ourselves. Don't wait till 120 to get asked these questions. Go on, I never thought of that one. Think about it now while we're alive. You know, the problem is, you know, when we're alive, everybody's worried. One of the most popular lectures here is, you know, we always know, we always get a big crowd, is reincarnation. Life in the next world. Hundreds of people come. Right? Why? Everyone wants to know about this world. Everyone says, what's going to be when I die? Why are you worried about when you die? Worry about now. It's going to be too late then. What are you going to worry about then? We have to worry, why am I here? What's my job here? That's what we have to worry about. So I'll tell you a question. The first question that we would get asked when we leave this world is, were you honest in business? Were you honest with money? Did you cheat anybody? Were you honest with man? Nasan Nasan bin Muna. Did you deal faithfully with your fellow? Isn't that an interesting question? Not so spiritual. Not about studying Torah. First question, were you honest? How did you deal with your fellow person, your fellow man? Were you honest in business? That's the first question. There's a debate of the order of the other questions, of the actual order, what comes next. But there's two other questions you should ask. One answer is, did you get married? Did you try and have children? Did you try to build a family? Did you make your efforts? It doesn't say, did you have children? It says, did you try and make the efforts to find a wife, to find a husband, to find a partner, and try to have children, to build a family? That's the continuity. And the other question is, you're very close. It doesn't say, do you study Torah? It says, did you fix a time to study? It doesn't say, did you study Torah? Because one of the most important things, which I'm sure you realize, because you're here, is the importance of the study of Torah. The continuity of Jewish tradition is completely dependent on the study of Torah. If you look in history, no Jewish community ever survived without the study of Torah. You can have beautiful synagogues and houses of prayer. There were places that had beautiful synagogues every day. People gave loads of money for these beautiful synagogues and shuls, and now they're dead, they're empty. They gave loads of money for chesed, opportunities for kindness, for helping, assisting, all the things. Great, helps amazing things, helps all the people. No continuity. The only thing which is a continuity is Jewish education. When there was a Jewish, in a place where there's a Jewish school, where the place, not only where the children are learning, but when people in there left school. I was brought up a community that basically, after your bar mitzvah, that's it. Studying is when you do your bar mitzvah, and that's it. But Torah study and learning Torah is for life. That's why we're here, that's why the JLE is here, that's why we set up to continue that vision. To ensure, to try our best for the Jewish world, for the survival of Jewish people, because the survival of Jewish people is completely dependent on the study of Torah. It doesn't necessarily matter how much the study of Torah is. It says when we get to the world to come, we'll be asked, did you fix the time to learn? Every day a person should fix the time to learn. You should have one time, whether it's 6 o'clock in the morning, or whether it's 8 o'clock before you go to work, whether it's your lunch break at work. Every day a person is after, it can be a different time each day, and it can be for 5 minutes. But did you fix the time to study Torah? First thing you do when you come home from work, did you fix the time? Just a couple of minutes, you opened a chumash, or you opened a book. There's so much, today we're small, the amount of literature which is written in so many languages. Did you go to a website and listen to a shiur? There's so many things to do. That's what we'll be asked. Okay? So these are some of the questions that we'll be asked. So there's also a concept. Eventually, after you ask these questions, then they'll start going through the Torah, of course. As you correctly said, right? So the first thing is there's the code of Jewish law. The code of Jewish law is called, what's called? The Shulchan Aruch, the late table. The Shulchan Aruch is the code of Jewish law. So of course, after we've been asked those questions, they'll open up the big books, they'll put on the computer, put in, God would have his iPod there, but then they see the whole person's whole life there, and say, go through. When I was a kid, you know, Rosh Hashanah, you know, they said the three books over the Rosh Hashanah, the good person's book, the average person's book, right? And I remember as a kid these big books with a duster, and you know, they say, no, it's a little chip for you, you know. So I always wondered as a kid, God, why do they keep these books? Everybody's got so many people on the one, everybody's judging all these books, why do they keep them? So we didn't know, they're much more advanced in heaven. Anyway, so the code of Jewish law, the first law, you ready for this one? Because I'm going to start with this one right at the beginning. So they'll open up the book, and the angel will be there, and we were standing there, everyone will be there, mum and dad, your grandparents, great-grandparents, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, will be there, and they'll say, right, the first chapter, the first law, Yisgaber Ka'ari, when you get up in the morning, you should jump out of bed like a lion, La'amoy Baboyka, to get up in the morning, La'avod Yisbora, to serve one's creator. In fact, you should be awake to awaken the morning. You should be awake at dawn. So when before the sunrise, you should already be up already. Okay, so many of us have failed on that one. Okay, so, alright. Didn't do so well so far. Okay, so, okay, next one. Okay, I'll go back upon him. At least if you don't get up that early, at least you should pray. Make sure you pray at the same time that they're praying in shul. Okay, so maybe we got a bit late, or maybe we missed that one. Okay, let's try the next one. This is still first in the first law. Shavisi Hashem Lenegdi Summit. God should be in front of me at all times. Huklal Godl Batorah. This is the great principle in the Torah. Umlasa Sadiqim, the ways of the righteous who go before God, that we should know and always be aware that God, the King of Kings, is watching us and is present and listens and guides and helps us and is aware of everything that we do, our thoughts, our speech and our deeds. And constant awareness that a person should always be aware. So this is a law. So it's quite near the beginning about the kind of called Shavisi Hashem, sometimes in the shul, at the front of the shul, sometimes it's written this concept about a person should always be aware of God. So this concept of awareness of God, not just by believing God or faith or trusting God, is actually consciousness of actually God's existence. We said this is a difficult concept because we can't see God. God isn't something physical, so how can we be aware of God's presence in our physical state? Hear the question, my friends? Yeah? No? Do you hear the question? Shall I repeat it for you?
Me?
Yeah? You okay? You got it?
I'm okay.
Okay, good. Just checking. Okay, making sure you're all awake still, okay?
Yes.
Okay. So you didn't fall asleep, it's okay, don't worry. I would. There's one shiur I give at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're welcome to come back on Shavuot, on the festival of Shavuot. We stay up all night and study. Hundreds of people come here, and we stay up the whole night. And maybe you can start one in Germany as well. And my favourite slot is teaching at 3 a.m. in the morning, the last slot, the marathon one. Because I'm the only one who's awake, because I'm teaching. And it's a great job to try and keep everybody awake. Anyway. Yeah. Okay, so that's the concept already. We've already seen Jewish law about awareness and connect with God. Now, there is a challenge that every Jew has, and that is that Judaism is full of action and practical things. Put a mezuzah on your door, the men put tefillin on, pray, shake a lulav, make kiddush, give charity. There's a lot of actions involved. And it's very easy when we get involved in the physical, the more physical actions that we do, bringing up raising children, getting married, all the things involve lots of physical activity and lots of doing. It's very easy to be involved with all these things and actually not connect God. I think it's happened to anybody here, but it's very easy. You can actually stand in the shul with a siddur, with your prayer book praying, and you can say all the words, and you actually say all the words, you go there for 2 hours, you can walk out, and you never thought about God at all. Okay, we can do all the motions. It's one of the biggest challenges of Judaism, to do all the physical actions and requirements, actually not be connected with God. We can do lots of things, lots of doing. So again, even by keeping the Torah, keeping the mitzvahs, doesn't necessarily mean that a person can actually be connected and conscious of God. On the contrary, sometimes the mitzvahs can actually take a person away. A person can be so focused on the detail of the mitzvah. Right? Don't get me wrong, anybody here been to Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem?
Yeah.
To Jerusalem? Anyone here been to Sukkot? You had a chance to get to Israel for Sukkot?
Mm-hmm.
One day you should get the opportunity to go for Sukkot. So you know on Sukkot we shake the Arba Minim, the four kinds, and if you go a week before, you find people looking to find Etrog. Right? And people there with magnifying glasses. They're trying to find, yeah? You seen this? Seen pictures? They're looking for some people say, you know, some people, what's a friend of mine was there, an old man, and a holy man, the tzaddik, and he said to me, he said, look, all these people looking around. He said, you know, Rosh Hashanah, I hope God doesn't look at us like we look for this Ezra. We're going to be in trouble. We get judged and looked at like if God looks at Ezra, we're in trouble. So he said, when I go to Ezra, I say, God, look, I'm buying the Ezra. This means, okay, God, I want you to look at me like looking for the Ezra. So again, I'm not saying that's wrong. Many people, it's called diktuk mitzvah. They're very precise. They want to be exactly and get this mitzvah exactly right. The more detailed person involved in, you get so caught up in the detail, because every mitzvah, there's what's called the body of the mitzvah, and there's a soul. Just like each one of us, we have a physical body, and we have a soul. And the same thing, every mitzvah, we're in a physical world. So we have to do a physical action. We take a mezuzah, and we do a physical act. But don't forget, there's also a soul to that mitzvah. There's also something spiritual to the mitzvah. What? I've just asked you a general question. Who are you? Are you a body or a soul? Or are you both? What are you? What are you? Yeah. You're both? What is you? What are you at essence then? Is your body really part of you? Sorry?
It is a party.
What happens at 120 when you leave this world? What happens to your body? Those big fat worms. Yeah? What happens? The body goes. That's it. The body goes. The body is only a vessel. The body is not actually part of us. I'll tell you what the Talmud describes the first man and woman, so Adam and Eve. What they look like before the sin. You know, they look like, it says, the Talmud says they were the heel of Adam's foot. The heel, which is the darkest part of the body, the physical body, it was so dark, it was so bright you couldn't look at it. That was just the heel of his foot. Because that was the soul. Ultimately, we are a neshama. We're a soul, and we're only here for 70, 80 years, maybe up to 120 years. The body is just the vessel which we're given. We have to look after it. God gave it to us. We have to make sure it's looked after, and bear and taken care of. When we have to mutilate our bodies, we have to make sure our body's taken care of, etc. But then it goes back in the ground, and that's it. Really, we are the soul. The soul is eternal. We're really ultimately we're a soul. The body is just a vessel to help us achieve things in this world. Because if you don't have a body, if you don't look after your body in this world, if you don't eat, the person dies and he can't achieve what he needs to do in this world. Okay? But ultimately, we are on the show, we are a soul. So similarly, it's the same thing in the mitzvah. When we're talking about a mitzvah, we have to be aware there's a body to a mitzvah, the physical mitzvah, the etrog, the tefillin, the mezuzah, the matzah and Pesach. There's also a soul to the mitzvah. And the soul to the mitzvah is God himself and connecting with God himself. Okay, now the next step is, as we're advancing here, is any questions? Okay? Okay. The first thing, the next step is, I'll be famous now. Okay, so the next step is that we live, as somebody called it, I was discussing this concept with a person, I always called it the microwave age, but he actually called it the fast food, it's the same thing. So we live in a world, everyone's looking for fast food spirituality. Right? I call it microwave spirituality, yeah? You know, basically everyone says, yeah, I want to be spiritual, I want to see God. I want to be connected with God, I want to see the truth on stand, and in 2 minutes. Okay? In 2 minutes, I want to press one button, I want to leave in the ball for a couple minutes, leave to simmer, and there, I'm connected. That's everyone's looking for instant Judaism, instant spirituality. That's the world we live in. And that's what makes true spirituality, anything valuable we know, anything valuable is investment. Any relationship between friends, between man and wife, any relationship, and the same thing between man and God, needs time. Anybody who knows has a relationship, a good friend, takes years. After a good friendship is for years. We've been, you know what, we argued, we fell out, we made up. It's investment. And the same thing in any relationship, parents and child, it demands time. Investment. Anything worthwhile, anything which is eternal, is not going to be instant. And the same thing here, a relationship with God and understanding where it's God, it takes time to invest in. As I started this year, when we started, it's a lifetime. I can't stand here and say, here's Rabbi Stepsky who's going to lecture on awareness of God. He's very aware of God at all times. It's not so at all. I'm also struggling with it as well. And there's times when I walk around in the darkness and go, where are you? Are you really there? I can't see you. I know you're out of this world, and I know you are in this world, but I can't see you. We all have moments of darkness. This is all part of the program. So it's something that's a lifetime of investment, of time to invest. And as we mature and as we grow older through life situations, that's where we'll learn those things. Next thing. The next step. Next step is, we live in a world, a mad world. The pace of the world, I don't know what it's like in Germany, but in London, it's mashuga. I'm Scottish, yeah. We live here, right? Scotland's been much, much calmer. I went there once for a holiday.
I haven't been there for
a long time. Glasgow, you should go. So you want to go? You should go to Scotland. It's beautiful, it's relaxed, nice. Here in London, it's mashuga, right? Life is going so fast, yeah. One of the strategies of the evil incarnation is, if you want to connect with God, one of the things is you need tranquility. Tranquility, peace of mind. It's a peaceful quietness, beautiful. Peace of mind, you think about what happens in a daily life and what happens, the things that happen. We live in such a fast world, everything's happening quicker and quicker and quicker, as we said before. Communication is quicker. things are happening quicker than ever before. We should have more free time, but everybody's running around, running. Everybody wants everything now. Emails, fax, blueberries, blackberries, strawberries, whatever. The whole world, it's running. It's everything's going fast. It's like the Hobbit times. It's like a big wheel, and it's getting faster and faster. And every generation gets faster. The pace of life goes faster. And one of the things is that we don't have time to think. If I said to you before, I said, you know, we should ask these questions to ourselves now, before we get, not when we're 120, we left this world. Say, I don't think about that, because one of the things is we go through life and we actually don't get the chance to think. Life is so hectic and so busy, and it doesn't get easier. Everyone says, you know what, now it's a hectic stage in my life. I'm young, I've got lots of things happening. Wait till I get a bit older. There's always something else, right? There's always something else. There's always another pressures and society. Things are moving. So one of the things is the person to create a time and a space for this. That means if your person wants to connect with God and understand God, understand himself and have awareness of God, it needs time. You have to allot time. Peace. Also, no, time and space. Time alone.
Yeah? Does it really matter if it comes later? I'm looking at myself.
No, it doesn't matter when it comes.
And it doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't matter when it comes.
I'm kind of missing the point here.
No, I'm not saying. What I'm saying is, we leave it to the end. Often when a kind of person gets to the end of their life, many people are there when they get to the end of their life, when it's too late and they're there in the deathbed and they go, the end is going! What have I done with my life? So that's what it is. We have to do. So many people, like most people, only hit someone when it's too late, when we can't do anything. So now when we've got our faculties and we're healthy and we're well, we've got energy, we should do as much as we can.
But I'm saying that I don't think it ever is too late, even if it is.
It's never too late, of course.
I don't think it's never too late.
Well, it is, and when the person's dead, it's too late.
Well, I'm not sure if you're right there. Either.
Well, he can come back into this world again. You're right. You might get a second chance. Yeah, but generally, this world is worth doing. That's what we're told. So you say a person has to try as much as he can this world, and the earlier person tries to do it. We should, in Yiddish, they say chaparam. Yeah. Okay, that's something in German. Chaparan. Yeah, in Yiddish, the chaparan. You have to grab the moment. You have to grab the moment, every opportunity. So one of the things is, if we hit another point, I'm trying to say is that life goes through, and it's very easy. Life as it gets faster and faster, and it's filled with busy with so many things that we don't stop to think and contemplate. That's the point I'm making. So once a person needs to make a time in order in his life to do it. So first of all, stop and think about himself, about his world, about his relationship with God, about his relationship with other people. He just carries on autopilot. And really, a person just needs, there needs to be opportunities to stop. And the truth is, that we have these moments. When you're walking from A to B, it's interesting. You think about your faults. I don't know how many, I'm not going to embarrass anybody now here, but probably every person in this room has actually, while you've been sitting, has actually stepped out of this room. Not physically, but in your world of thought, you've all been out of here. Can I ask anybody want to say where you went?
No,
particular. Some people may have gone to bed. Some people may have went to, God, I'm starving. You think about, were you eating supper? Some people might think, how long is this? You're going to go for it. It's very fine here. That's just your thoughts. It may be that you've actually thought about where you might be into Buckingham Palace. You may have been on an aeroplane. It's amazing. Thought is an amazing thing. Right, a person's thoughts. It's amazing we can achieve in a very short time. So for example, when you're walking from A to B, you're walking to work, you're walking to college, you're walking somewhere, it takes 5 minutes. Usually we just walk through the street and 1,000,000,000 thoughts are going to come. And you even ask, what do you think about? Sometimes people be for an hour. I don't know, 1,000 things. But if you choose to think about something in that time, you can actually achieve a lot. So you're walking from A to B, and it takes 5 minutes. Okay, now I'm going to think about X, I'm going to think about my relationship with God, I'm going to think about how I can improve as a human being, etc. You take a concept and you think about it beforehand. That's what I'm talking about. Creating space for the moment to think about it. If a person think about it, life is too precious and life is so fast that we just won't, it won't happen. Unless we create that time, it won't happen by itself. Okay, now we're going to go, we've got a few more minutes left, so I'm just going to run through. Yeah, we started the this evening. I mentioned to you that really awareness on the highest level is so much that the awareness is that our consciousness is stronger than our physical senses. That is a very high level. I'm not sure it's even something that we are capable in our generation of achieving. there's a few steps. I'm going to run through a few steps, just a few notes which I've made earlier. The first thing is, as we said before, first needs to create space, because it needs to create space to think about things. A person to think, it needs a few thoughts. Number one is, a person needs to contemplate and think about an idea that, if, remember we spoke before about awareness of God. God isn't physical, so if we can't see him, then he doesn't exist. So one of the things is just the concept to think about and chew over and internalize that our physical senses, the concept that physical senses don't give us the whole picture. We don't see everything, just like we know that from the radio and TV and a mobile phones, we know there's lots of waves going through there. We can't see them. We know they're there. They can be traced. So we know that they're there, all these waves. But we can't see them. We know we can't just that magic as well. Many forms of magic, of course, achiza sanaim, it's just a trick of the hand. You can't actually see. So you can't trust. The first thing is we can't always trust our eyes. We can't trust our senses. We're physical beings and we rely on our physical senses. But we, one of the first concepts is we can't only rely on our physical senses for everything we see. That means our physical senses don't give us the whole picture. That's the first concept. Step number two is the soul. The concept that to know, to investigate and try and discover, connect with our soul, to know that we have a soul, to believe, internalize that idea that there is, within each one of us, there is a spiritual dimension, there is a hole, there is a vacuum, there is a place of a soul. That soul does not have physical boundaries. And therefore, the reason why we find it difficult to connect with God is because we are physically limited by our senses. The person is aware that I have within me something called the neshama, something called the soul, which does not have these physical boundaries, then I know I can connect with God, who is also unlimited. That means that physically we cannot connect with God straight away. That means God, we need our souls to connect with God. We need to be aware of the concept there's a soul, so that the soul is aware of God and can be aware of God on the highest level. Step number three. As I said before, awareness is not something physical. It's something which is, God is not physical. It's a spiritual awareness of God. Now, usually the first area in the physically how we can connect with God, that means we want our souls to connect with God. The first level needs to connect through the neshama. But then it will go into the body. How does it go into the body? What is the most spiritual part of a human being? Or the physical part of a human being? Any suggestions? What's the most spiritual part?
The head.
Okay, close to you. Okay, good. Very close. It's okay, speech. Okay, there's something more than speech. Okay, it's something physical, something more. We've got speech. So we've had the head. No, you're trying to say physical. So it's like the most spiritual. You've got speech. It's like you can't touch me. You can't touch words. So what's something more spiritual? It's still above us. No? Okay, that's something action that's going to be doing. You're going down there. So you want to go up. Sorry?
The eyes.
Okay, but close that vision. Okay, go a bit higher.
The brain.
Okay, we're getting there. What does the brain do? Think. Thought. Okay? It's a thought. And there's one level higher, and that is emotion. And that is emotions. Now, emotions can be traced. If somebody feels certain emotions, they're plugged into the machine, and also you can actually trace emotions on the machine. That does not mean emotions are necessarily physical. It means they can be traced. But already, the most spiritual part is emotions. So the first level that we're going to connect with God is going to be through our emotions. And where does it register? In the brain. The first place it registers is the brain, and it's going to start going in the thought process. But also with something very spiritual part of the person. You say you can't touch, you can't grasp. As we said, it's unlimited. Literally in a minute, you could travel around the world in your world of thought. It's unlimited. Okay? It's interesting why it's the brain, because the soul, in Kabbalistic tradition, the soul lives, the seat of the soul, the throne of the soul is the brain. Not in the heart, the soul is actually in the mind and the brain. So it starts with emotions. The first level of soul connecting is, well, we're going to feel it, is emotion. Therefore, a person will feel awareness of God, feel somebody's watching me, I feel I'm praying, and I feel a connection with God. The first thing is going to be through emotion.
On emotions in your body more than in your head.
So that's what I'm trying to say. So we'll start in the brain. It first registers in the brain and then filters out, and then the body will feel it. The body won't feel it first through the brain, yeah?
But that's not how we feel.
No, you'll sense it first there, but the first thing will go into your brain. First, that's the first step. First, the emotion that registers into the brain.
When you say emotion, what do you mean? Because emotions, there's different types of emotions, like anger.
Okay. So I say, when I say emotion, I mean an awareness that that of an existence of God. Because I sense it, like, could be on, many people feel so on Yom Kippur, or Kol Nidre, saying, I feel God, really. Or the end of Yom Kippur, or Kol Nidre, there's certain times when people feel that connection. That's what it means. And a sensitivity to that. Okay? And the truth is this, we're running out of time. This basically runs through all the way through. So why it's through emotion, which goes through to thought. So next thing, if we want to transfer emotion, it means a person needs thought, is to think about things. As we said, a person needs time and space to think about things. Then we spoke about speech, so I mentioned speech. If you look in prayer, there's many things we say in prayer, like what the one is the highest level of prayer we say is Kedusha. That means usually one in the prayers that we say, Shema, one should not interrupt. One person that says Shema, one must not make any interruptions when he says Shema, except if you're saying the Shema, and in the shul, they start Kedusha, that's when everybody is Kadosh, 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 then one should interrupt the Shema and answer. Even Shema, which you don't usually interrupt, for Kedusha we can. What's the most important part of Kedusha? Kedusha, Kedusha, Hashem, so that's God, Malah, Chol Ha'aretz Kedusha. God fills the whole world. And we say it three times, twice a day in the morning, in the evening, we say it a few times in the morning service, comes up three times. It's a concept we say over and over again, Malah, Chol Ha'aretz Kedusha, God fills the world. Because the more we say something, so we've got to like thinking it, feeling emotions, thinking about it, and speaking and saying those words, the more a person gets used to an idea and turning it over into one's speech. And then the next level is action. But you're all right, all your answers are right, is into action. Who made you said action?
Me.
You're an action man, okay. Okay. Rings a bell. Okay. So then you've got the final level, which is action, which is mitzvahs. And also, that is, as we said before, the awareness of God's interest in the word mitzvah, which means commandment. Some commentaries say it comes to the word savsa, which means companionship. Because really what the purpose, many things are, the purpose of doing a mitzvah is to create a relationship with God. As I said before, the challenge is you can end up doing lots of physical deeds with no not even thinking about God. But really, what a person should know, what it's doing in Chassidus, is that therefore before a person does a mitzvah, you should think about why am I doing this mitzvah. Some say before you do a mitzvah there's a bracha. Some say the reason that our rabbi said you should make a bracha, a blessing, before you do a mitzvah is that I'm now about to do. The Noam Eilam Melech, one of the great Hasidic philosophers and tzaddikim, he said that before a person does anything, he should say first, I'm now doing this to connect with God and to fill the will of God. So before we put some money into the charity box, I'm now fulfilling the mitzvah spoken. Before he puts the fill in, before anything a person would do, I'm now going to pray. I'm now saying, Shema, I'm now putting a mezuzah on the door. Whatever a person is about to do, he thinks first what he's about to do. In fact, the Nefesh HaChaim, one of the disciples of the Vilna Gaon, he says, before a person studies Torah, because ultimately when a person studies Torah, he's connecting with God as well. But a person could study the whole of the Talmud and not ever think about God. The only way to connect with God is before a person studies Torah is to think first, I'm now about to, through this, to connect with God. But then he has to focus on that. So these are just some of the ideas that a person could do. And again, awareness of God is in a positive way, and it can use in not so positive way. A positive way that can inspire a person to be aware of God, that God is watching him, protecting that person, and guiding that person. One of the things, by the way, for awareness is sometimes to trace a person to think about. Many people say maybe it's not you can do is to take a week and think of each day in the week. Look for some, one thing happens in the day where you see God's guiding hand. Something you felt God's presence. Either you felt it, you saw it. Sometimes things happen, and you actually after things happen, so many things happen today we forget about things. But think of what, look out for things that we see. Often we don't realize a whole sequence of events, and then afterwards we see, oh, there's a guiding hand which has gone for this. But we should look out for it. Look out for one thing every day in your life. And write it down. Do it for a week. You have seven things afterwards. It's an amazing thing here. You'll see how many things actually happen. As we said, if a person doesn't focus on it, life goes flies past. Another week's gone past, and we only think about it. So we can only have awareness of God if we think about it. If we look for it, then surely we'll find it. So here we're giving some insight into the Hasidic movement a little bit, and about the major concept of the symptom and the awareness of God. And we shall have the, and may our eyes be opened, and may we experience the closeness and develop a relationship with God. Thank you for listening.